From Ground Zero Radio, this is Democracy Now in Exile. How vulnerable is the Saudi royal family? Why did U.S. bombers decide not to kill Mullah Omar when they had him in their crosshairs? How are the CIA and FBI clashing over the September 11th investigations? We'll talk to investigative reporter Seymour Hirsch. Then, as government officials announced the anthrax particles mailed to Senator Tom Daschle were so small they can float in the air without detection, senior officers in the U.S. military continue to raise doubts about the only vaccine available.
I refused to take the vaccine because we had discovered that the plant had been shut down by the FDA. The plant continues to remain uncertified today.
And many soldiers are applying to become conscientious objectors. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now in Exile. This is the War and Peace Report, broadcasting just blocks from where the towers of the World Trade Center once stood. I'm Amy Goodman. The Taliban has for the first time offered to hand over Osama bin Laden for trial in a third country without asking to see evidence first, senior sources in Pakistan told the British newspaper Guardian last night. The Taliban foreign minister, a man who's regarded as more a moderate figure in the regime, made the offer in a secret meeting with officials from the CIA and Pakistan's intelligence directorate in Islamabad on Monday. But U.S. officials appear to have dismissed the proposal and are instead hoping to engineer a split within the Taliban leadership. The visit coincides with the arrival in Islamabad of Secretary of State General Colin Powell. After several hours of talks with Pakistan's military ruler, General Pervez Musharraf, Powell admitted that moderate Taliban leaders would play a role in talks on a future Afghan government. Powell is in India today. Government officials announced last night that the anthrax mail to the office of Senate Majority Leader Tom Daschle is pure and highly refined. The particles are so tiny they can float a considerable distance through the air on the smallest of air currents without detection. The officials said the potent grade of highly concentrated anthrax could have been made by an expert capable of producing large amounts of it. Producing germs that can spread as a mist has been the main technical challenge facing bioweapons programs throughout the 20th century. The initial findings from an Army medical laboratory at Fort Detrick came as the police at the Capitol shut down a full eight-story wing of the building where the letter was found, including the suites of 12 senators with the same ventilation system. Hundreds of people who passed through the corridors near Daschle's office were being tested and treated with antibiotics. U.S. pilots have for the first time been told to choose their own targets and fire at will within specific zones around Taliban strongholds in Afghanistan. And President Bush asked American children to donate money to the children of Afghanistan. Tens of thousands of dollars were sent to the White House, which says it will give the money to the Red Cross. This might be especially useful now that a U.S. fighter has dropped 1,000-pound bombs on Red Cross warehouses in Kabul. The Pentagon said it thought the warehouse was being used by the Taliban. The Red Cross last night condemned the bombing, which destroyed more than a third of the food stored there and injured an Afghan security guard. Red Cross officials said the group's symbol was painted on the roofs of the warehouses, as it does everywhere in the world. Up to 5 million Afghan people face starvation. The Guardian is reporting that the Pentagon has spent millions of dollars to prevent Western media from seeing highly accurate civilian satellite pictures of the effects of bombing in Afghanistan. The images are taken from Ikhanos, an advanced civilian satellite launched in 1999, and of such high resolution that it would be possible to see bodies lying on the ground after last week's bombing attacks. The decision to shut down access to satellite images was taken last Thursday after reports of heavy civilian casualties from the overnight bombing of training camps northwest of Jalalabad. The Defense Department has the legal power to prevent access to civilian satellites launched from the U.S. in wartime. but because the images would not have shown the position of U.S. forces or compromised U.S. military security, a legal ban could have been challenged by news media as being a breach of the First Amendment. So the Pentagon bought exclusive rights to all such satellite pictures of Afghanistan off Space Imaging, the company which runs the satellite. And the Israeli tourism minister, Rahavam Zivi, was shot to death in Jerusalem today.
The more I love you, the language is leaving me. No more I love you, changes are shifting outside.
Lennox, No More I Love Yous, here on the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Saudi Arabian officials this week told reporters they're unhappy about the bombing of Afghanistan, sending the clearest signal yet that its relations with Washington are being tested by the so-called war on terrorism. The Interior Minister, Prince Naif, broke Saudi silence on the bombing late Sunday, telling reporters the kingdom opposed terrorism but did not approve of the U.S. response. The related foundations are to release information on the estimated dozen hijackers who investigators say came from Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia is caught between the demands of its allies in Washington and its own people, many of whom appear to support Osama bin Laden and oppose the Saudi royal family, which is increasingly seen as unstable, corrupt, and unresponsive to the needs of its population. Longtime investigative reporter Seymour Hersh writes in the latest edition of The New Yorker magazine that the Bush administration, like the Clinton administration, is refusing to confront this reality, even in the aftermath of the September 11th terrorist attacks. We're joined on the phone now by Seymour Hersh. Welcome to Democracy Now in Exile. It's good to have you with us.
Mm-hmm.
Well, can you lay out the documents, the National Security Agency intercepts, electronic intercepts that you saw that talk about the vulnerability of the royal family of Saudi Arabia?
Well, you have to understand it's a little more complicated than that. It's against, you know, the law is pretty tough on NSA material. What my article is based on is analysis of NSA materials and intercepts over years. And since I think the stuff that was made available to me were analyses of intercepts, including some raw material. But basically, it shows that from 94 on, we've been monitoring the phones of a number of the senior people in the Saudi royal family, including, let's see, Crown Prince Abdullah. He's been overheard. Sultan, who's the defense minister, his son, Ambassador Bandar, which I am. Binder really is the way they pronounce it there in Saudi Arabia, but Bandar, who's been the ambassador to the United States since 83, a number of other key players in the government. We've been listening to them, and it's pretty disheartening, I guess, if you look at it. For one thing, many of their private conversations, forgetting the morality of overhearing them, show that they're preoccupied with, as I guess everybody is, their share of the take. There's a tremendous amount of corruption inside Saudi Arabia. Nobody touches the oil business. That's sacrosanct. You don't take anything on the margins there. But all of the contracts that the government gives in the energy business, oil and gas business, and in arms are all bargained away. There's as much as a 40% kickback.
in those contracts. And there's a lot of discussion about who's getting what percentage of what take and how it works. There's a lot of discussion about prostitution, which is interesting given the fact that the Saudi regime's the most fundamentalist. The only nation as fundamental as rigid in their practice of the faith is the Taliban. And that is a public practice. You're compelled to go to prayers, and they have minders in that on the street that force people physically to mosque, as do the Taliban. A lot of stuff about alcohol, partying, girl talk with girlfriends, etc. All the stuff that sort of given. Again, the piety is sort of breathtaking in its sort of openness. King Farhad suffered a serious stroke in 95, according to The Intercept, and has basically been in and out of lucidity since then, often can't recognize people. He clearly is not able to run the state. One of his wives is playing a very key private role and using his name. Everybody tries to use his name. There's a lot of back and forth on that. The only point is we know all this. We know that this is a leadership that's increasingly alienated from its people, increasingly frightened by the growth of fundamentalism. And I'm going to actually read what I wrote, which is probably better than I can say it. I describe as The Intercepts depict a regime increasingly corrupt, alienated from the country's religious rank and file, and so weakened and frightened that it has brokered its future by channeling hundreds of millions of dollars in what amounts to protection money, like with the mob, to fundamentalist groups that wish to overthrow it. In other words, we've been tracking. What the Saudis do, apparently, is they use a series of charities and banks to wash money into any fundamentalist group that is viewed as a threat. They're simply buying time. As I said, it's like if you own a bar and the mob wants protection or they'll break your windows, that's what they've been doing. And it doesn't matter how increasingly anti-American and anti-West and pro-violence these groups are, a la bin Laden. The Saudi regime still finances them, while at the same time deals with us in oil and permits us access to their oil with a smile. So what I object to in this article, what I write about, is sort of how our government is reasonably happy with living with a Potemkin village. Fahad, Don Rumsfeld, the Secretary of Defense, went before the war in Afghanistan began, the bombing, went and saw Fahad and shook his hands, had a photo op, as they always have. Fahad can sit in a chair, he can open his eyes, he can shake hands, but he really doesn't, on any given day, know who he's dealing with.
So you have this description of the Saudis and the Americans arranging a meeting between Rumsfeld and King Fahd during the visit, with pictures of the meeting, but very clear that the United States knows that King Fahd's been incapacitated since suffering a stroke in late 95, and that Rumsfeld was there to talk with his relatives. You also talk about the questions that were asked of Donald Rumsfeld at a news conference in Saudi Arabia with Prince Sultan, the defense minister. Rumsfeld was asked if he'd given the Saudis a list of the September 11th terrorist suspects for processing by the Saudi intelligence agencies. Rumsfeld, who's admired by many in the press for his bluntness, answered evasively, "I am, as I said, not involved with the FBI that is conducting the investigation. I have every reason to believe that that relationship between our two countries is as close that any information I am sure has been made available to the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia." What did Rumsfeld get in return for this?
Well, first of all, you have to explain that the reason he didn't answer the question directly is that the Saudis are not helping us. There's reason to believe that a significant percentage of the people who hijacked the planes were from Saudi origin, and the Saudis apparently have not been helping our FBI, run what they call traces on the various suspects, which isn't very helpful. And so Rumsfeld didn't want to, by not answering the question or by redirecting it, which is a standard thing in Washington, he was protecting that notion. And in return, we got not much. We built a base there, a command and control base, a major command and control base for operating in the Gulf War, and we got permission to use that in the air war in Afghanistan. I assume that helped with some of the moving the planes back and forth. But probably, you know, we can also do it out of on floating bases in the Gulf, on Bahrain, et cetera. But still, we got that. And the answer is what we get out of them, of course, is an unfettered supply of oil and some cooperation on oil pricing, which is not unimportant. In other words, often Saudis will keep their produce more oil than perhaps they should at our behest to keep the price down, which is a from our point of view is very important. We also get, and this is not this is more indirect. Over the years, almost every senior official in and out of government, after leaving government, has done business with the Saudis, and it's almost you can't even calculate how that impacts. For example, the Saudis, one of the things they do through Prince Bandar, their ambassador, is they drop money all over. And they know how to buy influence, and they know how to buy access. For example, we know that money was given large chunks to the University of Arkansas and to the Clinton Library, where Bill Clinton, when Clinton was president. The library refused to tell the New Yorker how much, but money was given. I think $23 million was given to one project at the University of Arkansas at Clinton's request or behest. And so that kind of money buys access, and also just the sheer amount of American companies doing business there. Almost every, as I say, Halliburton, major oil companies, Aramco, of course, the major oil, consortium that's American, lots of American involvement in that. That's the company that draws the oil out of, runs the oil fields, nationalized company now. But anyway, you can't calculate that kind of business. What's really significant, what was, again, interesting about the materials that I saw was that among the disputes in the internal back and forth inside the royal kingdom was a lot of the concern about the Crown Prince Abdullah, who is seen by many of the other princes, particularly Sultan, the defense minister, and his son Bandar, as a threat. Abdullah is against corruption, and he's one of the few leading members of the royal family who's constantly urging his fellow princes to cut back. As you may know, there's a tremendous water and electricity problem in Saudi Arabia. There's problems. The problem in Saudi Arabia is the problem all over the Middle East, and the big issue, which is, of course, that nothing trickles down, to use that old analogy. None of the oil profits get to the people. So one way you can look at the fundamentalism is this rampant growth of in religious fervor. Another one is simply that so many people are denied a chance at the reasonable jobs, reasonable incomes, reasonable lives. If you're not members of the royal family, you don't get water, you don't get enough electricity, you don't get much of anything. And it's a breeding ground for, of course, discontent and fundamentalism. So it seems to me that what the Americans can do, what we could do, is stop playing this game that everything's okay there and the leadership's in control, acknowledge some realities, which is that Fahd is really a figurehead. The only reason Fahd's being kept in office, it seems clear from the intercepts, is because if he is declared legally dead or incompetent, Abdullah would become president, and a lot of people, or king rather, and a lot of people wouldn't want that. So he has, I think, 26 doctors in around-the-clock attendance at various times. That many doctors rotate in and out from England and America, Anglo-Saxons, and they keep him alive. And he's kept alive to prevent somebody who might be a reformer from getting in. And we sit and watch this while... I think one way you can look at everything that's going on now in terms of the bombing, whether you like it or don't like it, the anthrax scare, everything that's going on now is a blip. And the real issue in this long-standing war we're going to have with fundamentalism is to correct some of the underlying abuses that breed it. And that would be to these societies in the Middle East, Kuwait, even in Egypt, where there's a lot of corruption at the top, of course, most of the oil-rich countries simply do not let anything get to the people. They keep it at the top. And you have these enormous Brunei, you have these enormous places where the rich just live idle lives. And as somebody said in the article I wrote, described us as janissaries, you know, referring to the slaves in the Ottoman Empire, the one-time slaves. We're janissaries. We, the Americans, we serve, we clean their toilets and fight their wars for them. And it's ludicrous. And in the long run, we have to come to grips with what's going on in terms of basic fundamental values of decency. And you can almost use democracy with a small d.
Seymour Hirsch, we have to break for station, so identify
themselves.
Well, I've
got to go, too. So.
But I just want to ask you a quick question, which has to do with the second part of your article, the unmanned predator reconnaissance aircraft under the control of the CIA that was surveilling the roads leading out of Kabul, costing $40 million, cruising at speeds as slow as 80 miles an hour, and identifying a group of cars and trucks fleeing the capital as a convoy carrying Mullah Omar, the Taliban leader. Can you talk about what the U.S. military then decided to do after seeing Mullah Omar?
What happened is his convoy was identified. Apparently we know from public comments made last week by Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld that we do have ground agents. And apparently there was some information indicating this was the Mullah, and the command forces, he went with his troops into a house and secured a house. Whether he knew he was being observed or not isn't clear. This plane is apparently a very sophisticated model it's called a Predator. It's a pilotless drone. And anyway, the order was to fire. And there was a lot of back and forth with the command, the central command in Florida, because the JAG officer, the legal officer there, was appropriately, I think, up to a point, worried about collateral damage. And there's something good and bad about it. The good thing about it is that we are worried about it. There were people who worry about collateral damage. The bad thing is we ended up firing, the alternative was to fire a missile at some cars that belonged to Omar and some trucks. And when they blew up, the idea was to get Omar outside, and this pilotless aircraft would then take a photograph of him. Apparently it's got that capability. We can get a visual ID and then to elect what to do, obviously to kill him if we could.
I was puzzled, though, by what you wrote. You said that it was pretty straightforward, or you quote the CIA not having the authority to, quote, push the button, that they chose not to kill Mullah Omar.
It's not quite clear. What happened is, look, of course, I don't know everything about it. What happened is he escaped. They did bomb the building, and he escaped and survived. And there was particularly by the next day, they really had very specific information that they were right. I don't know how good the information was, but presuming the information was good, and presuming Mullah Omar was what everybody, then that's a reasonable assumption that he was certainly involved with bin Laden. Whether or not bin Laden and his people were responsible for the World Trade Center, he certainly is somebody who was... applauded what happened, supported directly or indirectly these efforts. And so if you're in a war, you're in a war. And that was the argument. Are we in a war or are we not in a war? Very complicated stuff. And there was a great deal of bitterness in the Pentagon over the decision not to fire right away and a great deal of anger at the central command. The ground being that, as somebody said to me, look, this isn't like you're 6 years old and you're playing outside, war outside, and your mother calls you in for dinner and you say, King's time out. You know, if you think otherwise, look at the World Trade Center. And frankly, I can understand that. If you think you have them and you think you're in war, you do war. If you don't, you don't do war. But now we end up, of course, bombing Red Cross things. It's a slippery slope, to put it mildly. Very complicated stuff.
And now we have this latest report from the Guardian newspaper that that Afghanistan is willing to turn over Osama bin Laden to a third country without even being presented with the evidence that...
If that's so. I haven't seen that.
That's the latest.
All I can say is that so far we've been predictable in terms of our response, and that's not very good.
You also wrote another piece, just very quickly, about the clash between the CIA and the FBI over who they believe al-Qaeda is and who is responsible for September 11th. Could you briefly summarize that, Seymour Hirsch?
Oh, all I can tell you is that I don't think people know very much. That's I don't think we really have anything really fixed. If you remember, there was a lot of talk by Secretary Powell and others, Secretary of State Colin Powell, about putting out a white paper. It never got out. Instead, we let some stuff slip out to Tony Blair in London. And I just think at this point, the fact of the matter is we don't know. And what's a little alarming to me, frankly, about the anthrax, we have to wait and see what it is. You know, it's certainly weapons grade, but it's a lot of weapons grade around. It's not quite as necessarily has to come from Iraq or some other state. But if it turns out to be another example of terrorism, well, of course, there's still cells operating. And that's the interesting thing to me is how much we don't know and how poorly organized we are and will be for a long time at this. Our police, national, federal police agencies, we're just, you know, we're not up to speed.
But you do point out that the FBI believes terrorists may not have been a cohesive group, while the Pentagon and the CIA credit the hijackers with years of advanced planning and practice and a deliberate after-the-fact disinformation campaign. So the stuff that's been found, like the airplane manuals, etc.,
yes,
in fact, were deliberately left to be found.
Well, I think that was a strong possibility from day one. From day one, people I know in the community, in the CIA particularly, pretty smart people. And, you know, and don't kid yourself, we do have a lot of very smart people. Often what comes out isn't always as smart as it should be. But a lot of very bright, dedicated people who care a great deal. And they were very worried about the fact that we found so much stuff so easy. The credit cards used to buy tickets and the, you know, I don't think there's any doubt. I'm obviously doing more reporting on this and will. I think the extent to which people had false visas and false passports and false entrance papers, et cetera, are far beyond the comprehension of any of us right now. And that some of the timelines just don't make sense. Somebody will get a visa in January and come in May, one of the terrorists. According to the public trackings we've had of them, and clearly they were going back and forth after getting a visa with a different name and didn't wait 4 months to come in. So there's a lot of very tough stuff left to do, and I don't think we're at square one yet on who these people are. I'm talking about the people at the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. I think a lot of the names will prove not to be real, and there's just a lot of questions, and it's going to take a great deal of time. I can tell you the one NSA story. Obviously, I have some access to their information. There was one person we were tracking. This is many years ago, 10, 12 years ago.
National Security Agency.
And a National Security Agency. They were tracking one person we knew was using false ID, and we followed this person as he used his right name, his wrong name, you know, around the world. We could get airline manifests and all that stuff, tracking. It took 2 years for the NSA running a separate computer program on this guy to break out all of his names. So it's complicated. It's much more complicated than, you know, I can begin. You know, I've been dealing with this stuff as a reporter for 35 years. This is all a new ballgame. And so that we're not going to have much information about who these people are. Is it bin Laden? Are there 1,000 bin Ladens? That's the other point. The point is that the focus on one person may be a huge mistake. And so far we've done that.
And you say George Tenet is on his way out, you believe, the head of the CIA?
I don't think there's any question that he won't be here after next year. I mean, I think the more I talk about it, the more I write about it, the longer he stays in office. He's not a bad guy. He's a very nice guy. He just never got a hold of it. They never, you know, you could go back 10, 15 years. The agency was beaten up by people like me quite a bit for running totally corrupt operations against the Allende and other things like that. But in trying to clean it up, obviously, they got rid of their capability to operate. And that was a little shocking, you know, no matter what. We don't want to be without intelligence. Nobody likes the idea of the United States going around and overthrowing governments because of political reasons, as I think happened with Chile, and particularly in the Nixon years, most offensive stuff. On the other hand, the notion that we've dismantled a foreign intelligence service in this era is a little distressing, and I think some steps have to be taken to get us better people working overseas who have an ability to get inside some of these areas, and it's not that hard.
Finally, do you think one of the gravest concerns of the Bush administration is the destabilizing of the Saudi regime, which it also has longtime personal ties to because of the Bush family's oil interests as well?
I think the real problem is that the other guys, the bad guys, whoever they are, the fundamentalists, the terrorists, can do what they want. The next call is theirs. If they choose to, as some have said publicly, if their goal is economic destruction in the United States, hitting the Saudi oil fields would be one way to do it. Because you drive the price of oil up, certainly over $100 a barrel, would be devastating to the economy of the United States, which has already been reeling in the aftermath of September the 11th. And so if that's what they're doing, if that's their goal, that would be a target. And although there's been tremendous steps taken to increase the security of around the oil fields in Saudi Arabia, which naturally you would, as somebody said to me, you know, cynically, well, who do you think the security people are? You know, that's one of the problems we have. Just as we're discovering that the security people in the airports weren't very good, at the minimum, easily infiltrated by anybody who wanted to infiltrate, mostly for drug dealing, in past years. We, you know, it's not clear how involved. You know, look, the bottom line is aggression of that kind can always work, at least the first time, as we found with our airplanes.
Well, Seymour Hersh, I want to thank you very much
for being
with us.
Yeah, it's a really uplifting conversation. I'm really, really fun to have, huh, Amy?
I very much appreciate you being
Bye-bye.
On because I know you don't like to speak about your articles, just write them. So thanks, investigative reporter Seymour Hersh. His latest piece appears in the New Yorker magazine. It's called King's Ransom, How Vulnerable Are the Saudi Royals? Before that, he did a piece called What Went Wrong, the CIA and the Failure of American Intelligence. You're listening to the War and Peace Report. When we come back, we'll be joined by a U.S. soldier who's just delivered a petition to the Food and Drug Administration. He refused to take the anthrax vaccine. We'll find out why. Then an increasing number of people who don't want to go into the military and are becoming conscientious objectors. You are listening to Democracy Now! In Exile's War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. A story just came over AP that said at least 20 people in Senate Majority Leader Tom Daschle's office have tested positive for anthrax. Government officials announced that the anthrax mail to the office of Tom Daschle was pure and highly refined. This means the particles are so tiny they can float a considerable distance through the air on the smallest of air currents without detection. The officials said the potent grade of highly concentrated anthrax could have been made by an expert capable of producing large amounts of it. But the nation's public and private health systems are ill-prepared for this kind of threat. Doctors and hospitals are deluged with requests for anthrax tests from frightened citizens and are turning most of them away. Public health labs are being strained to their limits as authorities bring in package after suspicious package for analysis. The German pharmaceutical company is tripling its production of the antibiotic Cipro amid fears that there will not be enough to meet demand in the U.S. and around the world. Nor is there a viable vaccine for the deadly disease. The one company in the U.S. that's licensed to make the anthrax vaccine, Bioport, hasn't done so in years. It's consistently failed FDA tests. And according to several high-ranking present and former military officers, the anthrax vaccine is still experimental and has caused sickness in thousands of U.S. troops. We're joined right now by Major Thomas Remfer. You're not authorized to speak on behalf of the military. Why is that?
That's true, Amy. Unfortunately, I'm not. You always have to caveat talking publicly when you're a serving military officer that your views do not represent those of the Department of Defense.
Well, yesterday you delivered a petition to the FDA. Can you tell us what it said?
Yes, I did, because even though I'm a military officer, I'm also a citizen. And under the law, specifically Title 21 of the U.S. Code, it reserves the right for U.S. citizens to petition the FDA commissioner to correct regulatory missteps. In the case of Bioport Corporation and in the case of the anthrax vaccine, the FDA has failed to properly regulate, and the petition asks for them to finalize a rule on the anthrax vaccine that they published 16 years ago, but it was only a proposed rule. They never published a final rule. It also asks them to declare the anthrax vaccine stockpiles to be adulterated because the vaccine's been changed without approval. It also asks them to enforce their own policies, which effectively would have barred the anthrax vaccine contracts with the Department of Defense because the manufacturer had received warning letters and a notice of intent to revoke their license, which, according to FDA policy, forbids the government from contracting with such a company. And further, it asks the FDA commissioner to suspend the license because the company's violations of current good manufacturing practices have met the threshold of license revocation and suspension.
Major Thomas Remfer, why did you refuse yourself? When did you refuse to take the vaccine?
In the fall of 1998, my commander tasked me and some officer colleagues to formulate questions for the chain of command to hopefully settle the unrest among within the ranks as far as their questions about the anthrax vaccine. So upon our most cursory research, we discovered that the plant had been shut down and that military researchers had, as early as 1985, deemed that the vaccine was inadequate, that the vaccine was experimental, and that there were serious questions of safety and effectiveness. So we simply asked our commanders to pass these questions on to the chain of command and find out why we'd be taking a vaccine that comes from a plant that's been shut down that the military has long recognized is inadequate. And we were essentially told to not share our information with anyone and ordered to resign. It was a very unfortunate time. It was 3 years ago. I think many of the questions have been validated at this point. The plant has continued to fail. Additional FDA inspections remains shut down to this day. But unfortunately, in the interim, over 500 service members have been discharged, at least 100 court-martialed. Almost 20 have been actually imprisoned and given felony convictions. And a survey by the General Accounting Office has actually shown that up to 25% of aircrew in the Guard and Reserve intend on leaving the service of the nation prior to taking this vaccine. And so the bottom line is we refuse to take the vaccine because these fundamental questions about safety, efficacy, and legality need to be addressed before we force the military to take vaccines that are experimental, which is in conflict with U.S. law.
Can you explain, Major Thomas Remfer, what it is that soldiers in the Persian Gulf War have come down with? It's commonly called Gulf War syndrome. Is it believed that something like more than 100,000 soldiers have been affected?
There have been tens of thousands of soldiers have been affected with Gulf War illness. The studies are ongoing, and I think most important, the Institute of Medicine is currently studying, as chartered by Congress, both the safety and effectiveness of the anthrax vaccine. And I think it's very important that until these studies are concluded, that the nation not proceed to approve this manufacturer and this antiquated anthrax vaccine prior to these studies being completed.
You know, it's interesting. Yesterday I was watching Paula Zahn on CNN, and she was interviewing the CEO of Bioport, this corporation you've been talking about, which, by the way, is run by the former chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, William Crow, even though so many people, once they privatized the company from the military. And she was saying, why isn't this? The question wasn't that it was dangerous. It was, why isn't this available to more people, this vaccine? And the CEO said, you know, we're going to do all we can to ensure that it gets out to more people. But you're raising some fundamental issues, as did our guest yesterday, Major Sonny Bates. MajorBates.com is a very good site to go to for the kind of information you're putting out. And Dr. Sam Young, who helped you deliver this petition to the FDA, the issue of the safety. Now, in the interview Zahn did with the CEO, he said that this has been approved by the FDA for 30 years. What's your response to that?
My response is that is false. The National Institute of Health approved the vaccine. If you read the inputs in the Federal Register, it almost appears that it was approved by accident, and they asked the company to provide data to support their licensure. That data was never provided. And as you mentioned, MajorBates.com, there's also another excellent website that hones down to the truth on this issue called anthraxvaccine.net. And the text of this citizen's petition can be seen at that website. The rhetoric of a long-term FDA approval is highly suspect. 16 years ago, the FDA reviewed this product and proposed a rule. They never finalized it. What this petition is asking is that the FDA finalize that rule. The CEO of BioPort Corporation, and I saw the interview, did say that they were intending on providing this product, once the FDA approves it, to the American people. And I think that it's very important that we understand that the license specifically precludes mass immunization and also directs only limited use for specific populations such as animal handlers and laboratory workers. And that kind of goes to the very core of the issue of whether or not this vaccine has been properly approved in the first place for the use that it's being mandated within the Department of Defense.
Again, the description, when Gulf War vets talk about the syndrome, Gulf War syndrome, can you talk about the autoimmune problems and the other conditions that these tens of thousands of people have faced, though it is controversial what it is caused by?
Yes, Amy, it is very controversial. It's also very confusing because there have been literally hundreds of confusing and convoluting studies that come up with all different kinds of conclusions. But I think if you take a look at the FDA testimony to the United States Congress over the course of the past 3 years, there are over 1,600 adverse reaction reports that have been submitted to the what they call the vaccine adverse event reporting system over this vaccine in particular. And the United States Army Surgeon General has maintained that this vaccine is not cannot be excluded as a possible cause of Gulf War illness. So I think the answer is we just don't know. And so I think it's very important that we take a step back and do it right. And clearly, this vaccine has long been considered to be inadequate, and that's all we're asking is that the government take a look at these issues and certainly take a look at the issues raised in this citizen's petition prior to doing something which might be a knee-jerk reaction, approving the plant.
Major Remford, what did you do during the Gulf War?
Well, I was an F-16 pilot during the Gulf War.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us. If you were going to make your recommendation to the American people, as alarm continues to grow, again, the latest news, more than 20 people in Senate Majority Leader Tom Daschle's office have tested positive for exposure to anthrax after he got a letter that contained a highly refined form of anthrax suggesting it was produced by experts. What would you tell people about the vaccine?
Well, I think there's a curious silence from the government right now. You're hearing a lot of rhetoric coming from the company and from former administration officials about the anthrax vaccine. I think the American people should wonder, why is an anthrax vaccine not available to the American people in general today? And it's an issue that the military has been wrestling with internally for the last 3 years. Military members of all ranks from around the world have been simply asking their chain of command to do it right, develop a vaccine if you think that a vaccine is the way to go that complies with requirements of the Federal Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act. Give us a vaccine that is safe, effective, and FDA approved. And I think the American people will want the same thing.
Major Thomas Remfer, thanks for joining us. Major Remfer fought in the Gulf War and has told us about the websites anthraxvaccine.net. There's also one, majorbates.com. You are listening to Democracy Now! And by the way, if you go to our website, webactive.com, you can also, if you missed yesterday's interviews with Major Bates and Dr. Sam Young, you can listen to them as well. We'll be back in a minute.
Now there are rumors in the camp about our enemy. They say that when you see him, he looks just like you and me. But you deny it, Sergeant, and you are a man of war. So you must give me lessons, for I've never killed before. Now there are several lessons that I haven't mastered yet. I haven't got the hang of how to use the bayonet. If he doesn't die at once, am I to stick him with it more? Oh, I hope you will be patient, for I've never killed before. And the hand grenade is something that I just don't understand. You've got to throw it quickly, or you're apt to lose your hand. Does it blow a man to pieces with its wicked muffled roar? I've got so much to learn because I've never killed before.
The Willing Conscript by Tom Paxton, sung by Pete Seeger, here on the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The U.S. bombed Afghanistan for the 10th day today, destroying a Red Cross building, further inflaming anti-U.S. sentiment in much of the Muslim world. U.S. officials, like Secretary of War Donald Rumsfeld, have said in recent days that the so-called war on terrorism may last months or even years, leading to increased anxiety and even resistance among men and women in the armed forces. Though there hasn't been a draft since 1973, there are still people in the all-volunteer military who consider themselves conscientious objectors. An estimated 1,000 soldiers inquired about objector status during the Gulf War, and tens of thousands applied during Vietnam. Many have also surfaced since the terrorist attacks of September 11th and the American bombing of Afghanistan. Although their reasons vary, most conscientious objectors would disagree that the notion that our job is to break stuff and bomb people, as one Air Force instructor told a recruit now applying for CO status. One of the first places that doubting GIs call is the Central Committee for Conscientious Objectors. And we're joined by one of its members now, Mario Hardy, on the line with us. Welcome to the War and Peace Report.
Thank you very much.
Can you tell us the latest figures of people asking about conscientious objection, and also what exactly it is?
Well, conscientious objection, as defined by the military, is an opposition to war in any form, not just the war on terrorism or the war in the Gulf or in Vietnam, but any war, an opposition to any war. And it's based on a moral, religious, or ethical code. Up until about 1948, you had to be a member of what was considered to be a traditional peace church, the Quakers, the Mennonites. But there was a landmark decision in 1948 that led to the formation of CCCO and our job, which is to advocate for secular objectors. Now we advocate for all types of objectors. But since the events of September 11th, we've seen the requests really just start to grow exponentially in terms of people who are actually in the military who are inquiring about conscientious objector status, and people who have, since they've been in the military, they've had a change of beliefs. You know, either it's been this war or, you know, a certain drill, or the fact that, you know, a lot of kids now who are recruited, they're told that they're only going in for money for college, or they're told that they're only going to get job skills training and that they will not be going to war. And now when faced with that reality, their beliefs are starting to change. Also, we've been getting thousands and thousands of calls and email requests from young people who are coming of age of the draft, of 17, 18 years old, from parents, grandparents, teachers, friends, who are inquiring about the likelihood of a draft as well. Back in 1995, CCCO helped to found the GI Rights Hotline, and the hotline is made up of several organizations who, around the country, who answer this hotline is 1-800-FYI-95GI, and we counsel people on discharge from the military. But since that time, all of the groups who helped to answer the hotline have reported at least a doubling or tripling in the amount of calls that we receive.
Mario Hardy with the Central Committee for Conscientious Objectors. On August 30th, 1990, 22-year-old Marine Corporal Jeff Patterson refused to board a military plane in Hawaii heading to Saudi Arabia. He was the first active-duty military resistor in the U.S.-led attack on Iraq. The photo of Jeff sitting on the airstrip defying orders to go to fight in the Gulf War appeared on TV and in newspapers around the world. Jeff Patterson joins us as well from California. Welcome to the War and Peace Report, Jeff Patterson.
Good morning, Amy.
Well, can you tell us why, once you were in the military, you decided that you didn't want to fight? In this case, it was in the Persian Gulf War.
Well, every story is different. My own deal was I joined up right out of high school. I joined the Marine Corps because basically I had nothing better to do with my life. And also I wanted to be tough, and the commercials were cool. I wanted to, you know, kick ass and see things around the world, basically. But it was those things that I saw for those next 4 years that got me thinking. You know, most of the time my unit trained to fight against peasants who were rising up in Nicaragua and El Salvador. I was in the Philippines where I saw dire poverty, you know, surrounding the bases. I was in Korea where I saw these U.S. government-sanctioned prostitution rings to service the U.S. services there. And I saw this unbridled racism towards the people of Okinawa and Japan. And one thing, you know, that really sticks to my mind is like when a kid would come up, when a little Okinawan kid would come up to our truck and wave a peace sign with his fingers, all my buddies would go, "Yeah, that's funny. Two bombs, little gook," and we all get a laugh at that. And it was through that process, you know, now that I look back, is I could see why many people around the world could grow to hate what they saw, specifically, you know, this U.S. war machine around the world and our covert Contra wars, which is what, you know, I experienced in Central America at the time. And faced with that, I began the process of thinking exactly what was the purpose of this. And in short, I became what I like to refer, you know, call as un-American, meaning that I started to see, like, I started to more identify with those people than I did with my own self-interest or my captain or anything like that.
And what was the response of the other GIs?
Well, it was split. You know, many people in the military do go in for many, many reasons. And there are others who we called lifers, meaning that was their life. Meaning if you ask them their birthday, they would tell you the date they graduated from boot camp. And it split down the middle. There are many people that said, "Yeah, you know, Jeff, stick it to them." You know, none of course. So, you know, I was vilified by many and threatened by some. But the fact is, you know, whatever I went through, I just look at what happened to the people of Iraq and the suffering that's happened, and I have no doubt that for a second that I did the right thing. And if, you know, I'm trying to get out a statement now that's going around the internet to you know, the troops of today, why there are plenty of reasons to oppose this war. You don't have to be a Quaker or a communist, and that you know, the people of the world do not need another U.S. troop, and you have something better that can be done with your life.
Mario Hardy, what are you telling people right now about what they can do, and how much have the inquiries increased or decreased recently?
Well, basically right now what we're telling people who are in the military, we have counselors all over the country who are actively counseling people who are in the military. Basically, the people who are calling, what we try to do is when they decide that they want to get out of the military, that they decide that for whatever reason, you know, there's up until September 11th, there was a lot of reasons why people wanted out, and those reasons still exist in addition to what could be considered a lot of the new calls, which have to do directly with conscientious objection. But there's still We're still dealing with sexual harassment, sexual abuse cases in the military. You know, we're getting people out that way. People who are being physically abused, brutalized. There's also people who were promised a certain job or training or skill in the military, and they haven't gotten it. People who have been promised $50,000 for college and haven't gotten a dime and don't see any of that money on the horizon, or not at least what it is, or nowhere near $50,000. So a lot of these reasons still exist why people want out of the military. We're counseling them around that. There's people who are AWOL. There's people who are who have unauthorized absence, and they're calling to see what's going to happen in case Congress congressionally declares a war. If they declare a war, a lot of these people could be facing execution, literally, for people who miss troop movements or are AWOL or UA during a time of congressionally declared war. So we're dealing with a lot of these cases. Also, in terms of conscientious objection, we are counseling people in terms of getting a conscientious objector discharge, but one of the things is that we're trying, a conscientious objector discharge can take anywhere from 6 to 12 months. And a lot of these people who call us are literally at the end of their rope. They're in danger of possibly harming themselves, possibly making decisions that could land them in the brig, in jail, for a considerable amount of time.
Jeff,
so what
Pat-
we work to do is to find the best discharge for each of these people to get out.
Jeff Patterson, you staffing the GI Rights Hotline?
No, I'm not, but I am talking with people in the military now via email and phone. And, you know, one guy is an Army lieutenant who actually spoke at the anti-war rally in Washington, D.C. on September 29th. And his position was, hey, I signed up to protect the Constitution of the United States. But now it seems that this government is taking away our rights, and that really scares him. And he is, and he's like, you know, like many of the people Mario are talking about, is trying to decide what is he going to do if he's, you know, ordered to the Middle East.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for joining us, Jeff Patterson, the first Gulf War resistor, and Mario Hardy, the with the Central Committee for Conscientious Objectors. Websites www.objector.org, as well as www.vvawai.org. Thanks, both of you, for being with us. And that does it for our program. And our next hour, for those of you who are staying with us, we'll be looking at domestic terrorism that's plagued abortion providers for years. Over 100 clinics around the country have been targeted with anthrax threats this week alone. And we'll be looking at India and Pakistan and protests from Canada to Italy. Also, we want to know what you're doing in your community. Please call us and leave a message. We'll be playing some of these comments at 212-209-2999. That's 212-209-2999. How are you organizing in this time of war? That does it for the program. Democracy Now! In Exile is produced by Chris Abrams, Brad Simpson, and Miranda Kennedy. Anthony Sloan is our music maestro and engineer. Errol Maitland is at www.wbix.org, where you can hear Democracy Now! You can also hear us at webactive.com and democracynow.org. Thanks to Amy Pomerlow at KPFA and to Free Speech Radio News producer Aaron Glantz. To all the folks at KPFA and affiliate station KFCF in Fresno, to all the Pacifica affiliate stations around the country who are airing us, we are Pacifica. We are broadcasting just blocks from the World Trade Center towers where they once stood in exile from the embattled studios of WBAI, from the studios of the Band and the Fired, from the studios of our listeners. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.
She asked me why. I just went on and told her.